two films, one theme. This is Words and Movies.
Thank you, Alex, and welcome to the next episode of Words and Movies. I am your co-host, Claude Call.
And I'm your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. And today we're doing part two of our two-part series of same titles, different movies, where the theme of the show is two completely different movies that happen to share the same title and yet are not a remake of one another. So today we're looking at two movies called Loving. One is from 1970 and is directed by Irvin Kershner. The other one is from 2016 and it's written and directed by Jeff Nichols. Now, along with the title, the only other things the two movies have in common are both of them center on couples, although wildly different couples. And both of them are essentially dramas, though the 1970 Loving has comic elements to it as well. Now, usually I do the trivia question in the second half of the episode, but there's an irresistible trivia question for this half of the episode, so I'll do it now.
Go for it.
One of the actors in the 1970 Loving happens to have something in common with Bill Murray, Bernie Mac, Ramon Rodriguez, and Patrick Stewart. Who is the actor and what do they all have in common? Well, I will reveal the answer to that at the end of this half of the episode. But for now, Claude is going to give us the plot description for the 1970 movie called Loving.
Oh, I might know that one. We'll review the question again at the end and I'll say for sure if I know it. All right. Anyway, the film opens on a scene in a New York City apartment. We see a man, he's an artist, and he's painting a picture of a woman. Nearby, a young lady, the subject of his painting, is gathering up her coat and other stuff to leave. As she walks around getting her purse, her coat, etc., she passes another painting in which she was also the model. She leaves the apartment, and he grabs his coat and a briefcase and goes out after her. Under the credits, the two of them walk through the city, clearly having an intense discussion that we don't get to here, but it's obvious both that they have an intimate relationship with each other, and it's possible she's breaking up with him. We later learn that the man is Brooks Wilson, played by George Segal, and the woman's name is Grace. Grace, it turns out, is Brooks' mistress. She's played by Janice Young. Brooks goes home to Westport, Connecticut, and immediately heads for an elementary school where some children are performing a dance recital. He watches the dance for a moment before walking the halls of the school to find a bathroom so that he can smoke a cigarette. Of course, he's immediately busted by a small dancer who comes in to use the bathroom and tells him there's no smoking. Brooks walks into a classroom and he contemplates the children's artwork, and then he draws appears to be a train on the chalkboard before returning to the recital, which by now has ended. The first adult he bumps into is Nellie, played by Nancy Phillips. Nellie is very flirtatious with Brooks, but he's mostly ignoring it, finally pointing out that her husband and his colleague, Will, is approaching. He's played by David Doyle. He finds his own family and compliments his daughter's dancing. His wife, Selma, played by Eva Marie Saint, asks him about something called Leopardon, but he says there's still been no decision. Back at the house, Brooks puts Selma through a series of poses and then photographs the two of them together as models for an illustration he's working on. In between the photos, Selma wonders aloud about whether his getting the new account means that they can look for a bigger house. But Brooks seems a little bit preoccupied with just getting the photo shoot done. The next day, Brooks has one of the photos he'd taken in a light box so that he can work on the illustration project. The phone rings and it's his agent Edward, played by Keenan Wynn. Edward tells Brooks that he has a meeting in a few hours in the city to meet with Mr. Leopardon himself. So Brooks has to get his act together and get himself into New York. This, of course, is the perfect time for his neighbor across the street, Mr. Cram, who's played by Edgar Staley, to bug him about the overall condition of his house. Brooks pushes him out of the house and sits down to breakfast with his family. His daughters are rambunctious and frequently arguing with each other, and it's clearly wearing him down. At the train station, Nellie spots Brooks from her car and invites him to lunch, probably with an ulterior motive. Brooks again brushes her off, saying he has an appointment in the city. He almost seems to respond in kind when she points out that Will is watching from the train platform, and Will is polite but a little bit distant. In the city, Brooks gets to his meeting and he runs into Skip Geyser, that's an assistant of Mr. Leopardon, and he's played by Roy Scheider. Skip apologizes and tells him that the meeting needs to be moved to the afternoon at the construction site for the new Leopardon building. So now Brooks has the better part of a day to kill. Brooks gets to Edward's office and has a conversation with him through a stuck door, during which Edward tells him that he'd arranged for a lunch meeting at the Illustrators Club to interview about a magazine cover. Brooks is reluctant to go because he's tired of doing all these small jobs. He'd rather have one large project to work on. Brooks buys a rose and he shows up at Grace's apartment, but instead of Grace, he finds a man playing the clarinet. Brooks says he has to get something, and the man just nods and returns to playing the clarinet. As he leaves, he tells the man to tell Grace he'll call later. Brooks finds Grace at the art gallery where she works, and he confronts her about the guy in the apartment. Grace is evasive and tells him she wants her key back. Brooks tells her he thinks he's getting the Leopardon account, but she doesn't care. He promises to tell his wife it's over that night. At the Illustrators Club, Brooks is at the bar, and we learn that he is not a member of the club, despite being an illustrator. After a rather humiliating encounter with a colleague and an older member of the club, he tries to escape, but he bumps into Benny, the guy he's supposed to be meeting. Benny has a lot to say, but he doesn't have the galleys that Brooks needs. Brooks joins another table, and it becomes more obvious that he's been drinking a lot. He meets with a woman named Susan, played by Sherry Lansing, and Al, another illustrator who's apparently curated an exhibit that Brooks finds rather macabre, given that all the artists are dead. His comments clearly irritate Al, and he and Susan leave. Brooks stumbles repeatedly on his way out of the club. A couple of hours later, Brooks gets to the Leopardon building, and Skip meets up with him and learns that Leopardon is considering using photography rather than illustration for his truck ads. Leopardon, who's played by Sterling Hayden, isn't totally impressed with Brooks' samples, but he did appreciate a Christmas card that he received from Brooks, specifically because the card was religious in nature. The card was actually sent by Selma. Leopardon thinks that photos are more honest than illustrations, and what's more, he can't understand why the ads have half-naked girls in them. He walks away, but Brooks pursues him and initiates a conversation with Leopardon, faking his way through a conversation about trucks. This actually impresses Leopardon, but the fate of the deal is still up in the air. Brooks arrives home, still a little drunk, and he and Selma get into an argument. But shortly afterwards, she asks about Leopardon. Of course, he still doesn't have an answer for her. We see Brooks reviewing slide images of trucks when he impulsively drops in a slide of a photo he had taken of Grace. At that point, Selma walks in and tries to convince him to relax just a little bit for the evening, but it just rekindles the argument. The next day, we see Brooks walking through the countryside near his home, flashing back on his relationship with Grace. And in the next scene, we have Brooks painting a nude model with his daughter playing nearby. This leads to a series of interruptions from the phone, and then Edward's assistant, Charles, who's played by James Mannis, is looking for corrections to several illustrations. And then the oven timer goes off, and then the doorbell again, and it's Mr. Cram, and Brooks just slams the door in Cram's face. Then he tells Charles that he's refusing to make any artistic changes until he hears from Leopardon, and finally, he returns to painting the nude. Brooks and Selma go into town to run some errands with the girls, and while they're in town, they bump into Grace, who is there with her aunt, played by an uncredited Betsy von Furstenberg, and her uncle Marv, played by Paul Sparrow. They're in town buying stuff for a big party they throw every year. Brooks learns during the conversation that Grace has quit the museum and will be going to Europe for an extended stay. Brooks and Selma go to visit a house that's for sale. The couple who own the house turn out to be there, and it transpires that they're selling the house because they're getting a divorce. The couple have a tense conversation with each other, and after the husband leaves, the wife is clearly uncomfortable, telling them about how they enjoyed the room that they're all standing in. After the tour, Selma apologizes to Brooks because she knew there was a divorcing couple in the house, but she was hoping they could get a good deal if they saw it early. Selma begins to break down, and Brooks consoles her. While getting ready for the party, Brooks and Selma have a lighthearted conversation, but it turns to talk of the house and becomes an argument that lasts all the way to the front door of the party. There are dozens of people there, and the house is full of technical marvels. Grace is there, of course, but she is ignoring Brooks. Brooks bumps into Will, and Will notices Susan, who's getting the tour for Marv. Marv demonstrates an entertainment center hidden behind a bookcase, but the entertainment center also features a closed-circuit video system that allows someone to monitor the entire house. Brooks goes upstairs to an empty bedroom and places a phone call to Edward, who tells him he's got the Leopardon account. Selma walks in as he hangs up, but Brooks lies to her and says he still doesn't know for sure. They appear to reconcile, and Selma wants to go back home, but Brooks protests that they just got there. They begin close dancing at the party, and Grace watches from across the room. Later, Brooks lures Grace into a pantry and begins kissing her. He's trying to convince her not to go to Europe. Grace says she loves Brooks, but notably he doesn't reply in kind, and Grace flees the room. Brooks sits on the stairs, getting drunk. Susan gets very drunk and has to be carried upstairs. Brooks overhears another partygoer talking about art, but he's terribly pretentious, and worse yet, he doesn't entirely know what he's talking about. Brooks calls him out on it, and it nearly starts a fist fight. One of the witnesses to this is Nellie. They're both a little drunk, and Nellie is being Nellie, so they go off together. Marv, walking the house, is seen going into the room where Susan was taken. Outside, Brooks and Nellie are fooling around in her car, but they eventually move to the children's playhouse on the property. Unfortunately, Brooks has forgotten all about the closed-circuit video system, and they're busted when someone fooling around with the entertainment system switches over to the video feed and then just walks out of the room. Will gets into a brawl with Brooks, which most of the guests are content to just watch, until Marv finally breaks it up. As everyone finally goes inside, Grace is left standing on the porch watching him recover before she finally goes in as well. As Brooks retrieves his pants from Nellie's car, he hears his own car revving up. It's Selma trying to leave, but she appears to be stuck in the snow. Trying to placate her, Brooks tells her he got the Leopardon account. She beats him repeatedly with her purse and then spits on him. And the two are left just looking at each other in the cold, snowy driveway.
All right. Now, Claude.
Mm-hmm.
I've asked you this before, but for the record,
okay.
On your other podcast, How Good It Is, where mm-hmm. you talk about music, you have not talked about the song Little Boxes, correct?
I have not.
Yes.
You're talking about the Pete Seeger. Well, it was made popular by Pete Seeger. But
it was made popular by Pete Seeger, but it was written by
Melvina Reynolds.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And her version became popular when it was used in the first season of the Showtime comic series Weeds.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I've only ever watched the first season, but I believe that different versions were recorded for the other seasons, just as The Wire used different versions of Tom Waits's Way Down in the Hole throughout each of their five seasons.
That would be correct.
Anyway, let me read to you some of the opening verse of Little Boxes. Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. And then there's a later verse which says, and there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And she is talking, or she was writing, about what she perceived as life in the suburbs. Now, when we talk about the suburbs today, hopefully the better informed of us fault them for the fact that although the suburbs were a great boon to many people coming back from World War II, when, thanks to the GI Bill, among other things, they received enough money to buy a house where their family could live in, that was a privilege only extended to white people and not people of color. And then also, even people who didn't come back from World War II participated in white flight from the cities to the suburbs. And we would also fault the fact that environmentally, the suburbs have not been that good, thanks to someone's insistence on all on the best look for these houses, all having perfectly manicured grass instead of plants or such that would actually help the environment. But
right, it's all, and it's also worth noting that the model for these houses was Levittown. Okay. And there are many Levittowns across the country. The most notable one would be the one that was first done out on Long Island. And a lot of those houses had asbestos shingles besides. So also not great for the environment because it was the cheapest stuff around.
But back when suburbs came to prominence after World War II, and before anyone knew about or took seriously the health hazards of asbestos, and before anyone took seriously the idea of white flight or anything like that, suburbs were seen by some, including Malvina Reynolds, as a place of conformity, mm-hmm. where people looked, thought, and acted all the same. And there was quite a lot of literature, quite a lot of movies, and there's also been a few songs about the idea that the suburbs are a place of conformity. My first exposure, any music in that regards, was the song Subdivisions by Rush, which I gather you have not talked about on your show either.
No, I have not.
Okay. But, you know, novels written by such novels and short stories written by such folks as Philip Roth, John Cheever, and John Updike, particularly his Rabbit series, all deal with this stifling of the suburbs. Stifling image of the suburbs, and movies such as Diary of a Mad Housewife, which is also based on a novel, and also movies that are more genre movies, like the horror slash science fiction novel and movie The Stepford Wives, where all those submissive housewives are actually robots built by men.
Right, and I would also say that True Stories kind of gives a nod to it. It's not all about that, but there's definitely an element of it there.
And, of course, as I've argued before, with every action comes an equal but opposite reaction, applying not just to science, but also to culture. There's been a pushback in some circles against that idea that the suburbs are just a hotbed of conformity and that the suburbs can actually be a nice and even magical place to live in. Steven Spielberg's E.T., although I don't know if he was specifically rebelling against those types of suburban movies, is probably the best known and certainly the best example of that. Now, having grown up in the suburbs in New Jersey and California, and having lived in the suburbs a lot of my life, I can say that I've seen both the best and the worst of the suburbs. And so I am neutral as to whether they should be portrayed in a good or bad life. What I can say is, as far as movies that portray the suburbs in a somewhat conformist light, while Ang Lee's version of The Ice Storm is probably my favorite of those types of movies, Loving is my second favorite. And I'm going to get to why in a moment, as well as how I came to watch this movie, because it's not a terribly well-remembered movie per se. But first, Claude, what did you think of it? Did you think it captured the movie, or are you one of those people who thought, oh, what is this conformist crap?
No, I think it's a kind of an undercurrent throughout the film. I don't think it leans on it too heavily, except as a it's kind of a distant dream that Selma is having. And we should, by the way, I mean, Eva Marie Saint recently celebrated her 99th birthday, so we should wish her happy birthday there.
Yes.
And by recently, I'm saying we recorded this the same week. So but it, you know, when you've got a lot of the film taking place in Manhattan and then another part of it taking place in Westport, which was at the time the common commuting ground for people who worked in the city. If you weren't in Westport, then you were somewhere out on Long Island for the most part. So that sounds a little bit peculiar that he's going clear out to Connecticut, but that really was a common place for people to commute to, and may still be for all I know. At any rate, you know that they are in a house. It is a relatively small house and probably in that Levittown model, because the original houses were like something like 700 square feet. They were very, very small. And it was only over the years that people started doing additions and putting on garages, because there weren't any garages, and doing other things like that, that the houses no longer look quite so cookie cutter anymore, unless you really stare at them and you can see, oh, there's the original frame of the house. At any rate, you know, this is Selma's thing, is she wants to move up in the world. She wants to get into something a little bit more suburban than the suburban place she is in now. And I'm sure, you know, being friends with Harv and his wife, who I don't think has a name in the film, I don't recall it anyway, and they've got this gigantic place. You know, I think at one point we're told it has something like 40 rooms. It's enormous and so forth. So they've got friends who are doing better than they are financially or economically in general. You know, and part of that is because of, you know, Brooks, and he's got a certain attitude toward his art. He doesn't want to take certain jobs. He's kind of fussy about other things. He also got a late start in the business because he had been in the army or whatever. He'd been in the military. He got into his art school on the GI Bill. So he's a little bit of an older guy in the industry. And so there are younger people who are a little bit more advanced than he is. And, you know, that's kind of nagging at him too. And that becomes a little bit of a, you know, friction point for him and for his relationship with his wife and her. You know, it's not exactly social climbing. I think she just wants to have a nicer place, really.
No, I understand that. I mean, certainly this movie isn't as obviously stylized as, say, The Ice Storm, mm-hmm. where early on you see that shot of Kevin Kline's character waiting at the train station, and everyone is dressed in the same colored trench coat.
Right.
Or, say, another more genre suburb movie, although wildly different, Edward Scissorhands.
Okay.
Where all the lawns look exactly the same. And, you know, that design is a very close approximation of the song Little Boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, you do get somewhat of the conformity of the place, you know, with the neighbor,
Mr. Cram,
Mr. Cram, who is always telling Brooks that he needs to mow the lawn so that it conforms to the look of the rest of the houses. And Brooks angrily telling him at one point that he likes how messy it is and he's not going to change it for anyone.
Right. It's not even just mow the lawn. It's because you've got crabgrass and, you know, that's apparently a problem of some kind. It's like, and you know, and that's funny because I'm kind of, my attitude's the same way. It's like, I don't care. As long as it's green, we're good. You know?
So this is a movie that I had never even heard of until I picked up a collection of Pauline Kael's reviews called Deeper Into Movies, I believe was the one. And she gave a rave review of this movie, which was movies that came out from 1969 up through about March or April of 1972. And while this is based on a novel called Brooks Wilson Limited by J.M. Ryan, Don Devlin adapted the novel, which I have not read. Hale apparently did, because she mentions in her review that although she liked the movie, she felt that there were sequences in the novel that either weren't filmed at all or were filmed but not included in the movie that she thought would have made the movie an even richer and better experience. But she still liked the movie because she thought that it captured a lot of the confusion that you described Brooks and Selma both having in the movie, about they're not satisfied with the life of what they have and they want it to change, but Brooks at least is not sure exactly what he wants to change to or how he wants it to change, which I think is one of the reasons for me anyway why the movie works so well.
Yeah, I understand that. And you know, Brooks is weird because he in so many ways is it's like his personal life, his professional life, you know, just every aspect of everything. He is a self-sabotaging kind of guy. You know, he wants the Leopardon account because he wants to work on one big project. And at the same time, he's I don't want to draw trucks for the rest of my life. So, you know, he's always got this little, you know, push and pull thing going on within his own head. You know, he wants Grace, but he doesn't want to leave Selma. He wants to have her forever, but he doesn't want to do what he needs to do. He wants to be a big deal artist, but he doesn't want the big accounts. It's like, you know, everything he seems to do is like just shooting himself in the foot here.
Right. Now, one of the reasons why the movie works for me is thanks to someone who we've talked about on quite a few episodes of the show, and that would be cinematographer Gordon Willis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you only think of him for the Godfather movies or the movies that he did for Alan J. Pakula, one of which we've discussed, The Parallax View, you might think of him as someone who only did these very stylized movies, even though, as we've argued, his approach to cinematography was to try and take something, or one of his approaches, I should say, was to try and take something that's very complex and reduce it to something simple without being simplistic. And that's certainly the case with his cinematography here. You know, he doesn't do a lot of obvious contrasts with light and dark the way he does in the Godfather movies or in the Parallax View or in All the President's Men, to pick just some examples. But he shoots everything naturally,
mm-hmm,
so that it doesn't come off like he's trying to make us feel biased toward one part of Brooks's life as opposed to another. Now, obviously, the party in the last part of the movie that serves as the climax, you know, a lot of that is darkly lit or uses low-level lighting, but it takes place at night,
mm-hmm,
and during the winter time. So, of course, there's not going to be a lot of light there. And Willis makes it dark without being obvious about it or being heavy-handed about it either.
Right. Again, he does a lot of like eye level type stuff. More often than not, if it's not an eye level thing, it's a point of view shot. He's, you know, somebody's looking out a window, so you get to see what they're looking at. Or in the case of Brooks on the Stairwell, you know, it's him, like, you're looking over his shoulder. I think the only time we don't get that, there's an overhead shot, is when he first gets Grace into the pantry to try and seduce her. And then she leaves again. There could be others, but I think that's the only one that's coming to mind offhand. And you got to say it, nobody photographed New York City the way that Gordon Willis did.
Yes. You know, and he did that especially in his Woody Allen films.
Mm-hmm.
Those were all terrifically photographed. Now, another reason why the movie works so well for me anyway are the performances of George Segal and Eva Marie Saint. Now, if you only know Segal's work from sitcoms or his appearances on The Tonight Show or later movies where it seemed like he was only doing shtick, once upon a time, he was a very naturalistic actor, and he could play both comedy and drama equally well. This was around the beginning of a very good period for him, where he also did, among other things, Born to Win, where he plays a junkie. And although this was a few years later, California Split, Robert Altman's movie, where he played a compulsive gambler along with Elliot Gould. And in all those movies, he's giving a very realistic performance. And even though, as you said earlier, a lot of Brooks's troubles are brought on by himself, you or I can't help but feel for the guy a little.
Well, yeah, it's true. And, you know, it's not just him. It's really everybody in this film. There were so many people. I mean, even minor characters are relatively so, that just struck me as like they were well cast. They did the job well, you know, and I'm thinking of like Nancy Phillips and Janice Young, who didn't do very much other than this film. And, you know, Betsy von Furstenberg, who is mostly a stage actress, you know, and I think this was one of what, two films that she did.
Right.
You know, but so you had like Sherry Lansing also, just, she had a very short career and she, you know, moved into other stuff, but, you know, still within the industry, but still the point being that, you know, you had a lot of people who were very well cast and you really, really bought into them. And even Sterling Hayden, who is a little bit of a cartoon character for the role that he's playing here, you know, you still kind of buy into, you know, his character. He reminds me a little bit of the guy who ran the, the airline in Nothing in Common. You know, and
Barry Corbin's
character. Yeah. And it was the same kind of thing. He's a little bit weird, but in the bottom line, he's a good businessman. He knows what he wants. And you just kind of have to like play into that crazy just a little bit in order to do what you need to do.
Well, I'm going to get to the rest of the cast in a moment. But first, Let's get back to Eva Marie Saint.
Let's do.
Now, she is someone who I always thought should have had a bigger career than she did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had her Oscar-winning turn in On the Waterfront, and she holds up very well playing against Cary Grant in North by Northwest. And then after that, she didn't get much as far as her career goes. I mean, she did do very well in Nothing in Common, also playing Tom Hanks's mother and working well both with him and with Jackie Gleason. But then she'd get stuck in things like The Sandpiper. But In this movie, she is really good. And there's two scenes in particular that I want to point out. The first is the one where she's posing for Brooks in all the photographs that he's taking of her for his drawing. And you can see just in her face that combination of love and exasperation that she has for him, that Selma has for him. And then in the scene where the TV goes on so that everyone can see what Brooks and Nellie are really up to in the children's house, Saint makes a very interesting choice. She doesn't cry right away. She moves her hand to her neck as if she's trying to cover herself up. And yeah. That body language and just the expression on her face capture the feelings of betrayal and anger that she's feeling and sorrow much better than I think a conventional crying scene would have.
Yeah, well, she and David Doyle both do this similar kind of thing where they enter the room, they see there's something going on the TV. It's kind of amusing. Oh, look at these two people going out. And at first, like, oh, we're watching a porno. And then next, it's like, no, this is video. And then next is, wait a minute, isn't that, you know? And I think actually when David Doyle is watching the video, he hears somebody identify a person in the video. And that's when it kind of like snaps into place for him. But for her, it's the same kind of thing. She comes into the room and she's like in a decent mood and she hears people laughing and she's going to kind of laugh along with them before she realizes what's up and then does the clutch on her neck. And yeah. And starts to just completely unraveled over it. But at the same time, like, it's an internal unraveling. You know, she's kind of sort of holding it together on the outside. She's going to put on the good face, at least for the time being. And she's not going to let that go until the very end when he tries to say something that's, hey, look, here's some good news. And she's like, I'm going to kill you now.
Right. Now, let's talk about the rest of the cast, which is full of people who are considered, hey, it's that guy, to quote the old website. Now, we should start out by saying that for those who don't know, Sherry Lansing may not have had a long career as an actress, but she later became a film producer and a studio executive, and one of the earliest female studio executives in Hollywood. And the couple whose house Brooks and Selma take a look at, the mother or the wife is played by Diana Douglas, who is probably best remembered as Michael Douglas's mother, although she also had a short acting career. And the husband is played by Ed Crowley, who didn't do a lot of movies, but he worked with Sidney Lumet a lot. The movie I best remember him is in Running on Empty, where he plays River Phoenix's music teacher. And he's got that great opening part where he first dances along to Madonna's Lucky Star and then conducts a Beethoven, an excerpt from a Beethoven symphony, and does that rather well. And then Roy Scheider, this was one of his first roles. The year after this is when he appeared in The French Connection, which helped make him a star. And then also, although I don't know if you talked about his part too much, Sab Shimono also appears in this movie. This was his first movie role. He's done a bunch of movies and TV. I remember him best as the North Korean spy who gets a job as Winchester's servant as on an episode of MASH, as well as the coroner given the derisive nickname of Painless in the movie version of Presumed Innocent. And then there is also one person who I'm going to save for later, of course. And Sterling Hayden, I know that you thought that he was a bit cartoonish, but considering the fact that he owns a trucking company and is trying to project a macho image for the company, I think his behavior there was appropriate for the role. Mm-hmm. And for the movie. And then also Keenan Wynn, while this was near the end of his career, and you could argue that his part could have been played by a lot of different actors. He didn't do anything really distinctive, but he's always watchable on screen, and he was watchable here as well.
Yeah, to be sure. I did enjoy his character. And there is a scene that he does with his assistant, Charles, excuse me, which where they're just having like this weird discussion about rubber cement. And it's a funny scene. It's not really meant to advance the plot or anything like that, but it gives us a little bit of an insight into what kind of guy Edward is.
Right. Now, let's talk about the director a moment, Irvin Kershner. Now, today's audiences might best remember him for directing genre movies. Specifically, he directed the movie that many people, myself included, believe is still the best Star Wars movie, The Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. And he also went from that to directing RoboCop 2. And right before he did Empire Strikes Back, he also did a cult horror slash thriller movie called The Eyes of Laura Mars, where Faye Dunaway plays a fashion photographer who for some reason is able to see murders committed by a serial killer. And it's better than it sounds. It's very crazy and off the wall, but I do believe it's better than it sounds. But before he did all that, he did movies that were sort of like this, in that they were very character-based and did not have a lot of happy endings for the characters. He did a Canadian movie with Robert Shaw called The Luck of Ginger Coffee. And good luck trying to find that unless you live in Canada. But if you are able to track it down, it's well worth it. He did a movie with Sean Connery called The Fine Madness. And while there was studio interference with that, apparently, it also has what I think are flashes of brilliance. And
he did another Sean Connery movie, too, by the way.
Never Say Never Again. Yes,
indeed.
another one of the genre movies. The only unofficial Bond movie
yeah,
that Connery did. And while I'm not a fan of Barbara Streisand, he did what I think is one of her best movies, Up the Sandbox. But again, he and scriptwriter Don Devlin and Willis really pay attention to the characters, so it feels like the characters are driving the story along rather than the other way around, which is how I generally prefer movies to be.
Yes, absolutely.
So, do you have anything that you want to add before I reveal the answer to the trivia question?
No, go for it.
Okay, so Again, the question was, one of the actors in this movie has something in common with Bill Murray, Bernie Mac, Ramon Rodriguez, and Patrick Stewart. Who is the actor, and what do those folks all have in common? Well, that actor is David Doyle. And all of those actors have played the character of Bosley in some incarnation of Charlie's Angels. Doyle played Charlie's Angels, played Bosley on the original TV show of Charlie's Angels that ran from 1976 to 1981. And Bill Murray appeared in the 2000 movie Charlie's Angels, and because he treated some of his co-stars, particularly Lisa Liu, rather shabbily, he was not asked back for the sequel, Charlie's Angels Full Throttle, so Bernie Mac played him in that movie. And then in the attempted 2011 Charlie's Angels spin-off TV show, Ramon Rodriguez played the part of Bosley, although in this incarnation, he was known as a hacker. And then finally, in the 2019 movie spin-off, directed by Elizabeth Banks, it was Patrick Stewart who assumed the role of Bosley.
Okay. Yes. I would have been completely wrong. So I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm not going to embarrass myself. Once I heard the list of names again, I was like, nope, my answer is wrong. So I just said, that's enough of that.
All right. So when we come back, we're going to talk about the 2016 Loving.
That's coming up immediately in your podcast feed. So stick around.